Okay, we continue with the conceptual framework, and more particularly with the paper by Roger and Andrew.
Andrew, are you going to remember Roger?
I'm just going to introduce it and then hand over to Andrew. And just to say, this paper follows on from some very interesting and good papers. First of all, from Japan, I think that was two meetings ago, and then from Tom at the last meeting. What we try to do is build on that and perhaps bring together some of the ideas. So Andrew's going to present the paper, and we're very interested to get everyone's comments.
Thank you, Roger. I'm sure that you've all read the paper, and therefore I don't propose to bore you to death by going through it exhaustively. I've put around some slides which try to bring out the key points, and just as a refresher, I'll try to skip through those really very straightforwardly. As Roger has said, this builds on earlier papers. I should apologise that we didn't send it to either the ASBG or to Tom to see before we distributed it, because we were dickering around with it until the very last minute. So I'm sure that if we've misrepresented them, they will let me know either in the meeting or outside. As Roger said, it brings together a number of ideas. I've heard two kinds of comments on the paper in particular. One is that it doesn't address certain issues, which is perhaps unsurprising given its length. The other is that it deals with a number of different issues. And really, I think what we were trying to do was to try to bring together a number of ideas and show how they reinforce each other, which is the kind of thing that a conceptual framework is supposed to do. So we thought that it might be useful in that connection. Two of the key ideas that are close to our hearts are prudence and the business model, and slide three sets those out. Just to say that we think there are two aspects to prudence about which I will say a very few words. And the business model, we're not over-engineering, we're simply taking it to be something to do with the way in which a business creates or adds value. One of the aspects of prudence is asymmetry. What the academic literature refers to as timely loss recognition, and there are several academic studies that show that the importance of that, and we give some examples of those on slide four. The other aspect of prudence, which is perhaps less relevant to the rest of the paper, I don't know, is caution as a response to uncertainty, and perhaps the most important point to emphasize there is the negative one, that it the cautious approach does not allow the deliberate understatement of assets or overstatement of liabilities. To that extent, prudence would seem to be compatible with neutrality. What about asymmetry? Well, we argue that neutrality is well described in the current framework as deliberate manipulation or bias, trying to influence people in the way that you present information. And we would suggest that simply adopting asymmetric accounting policies, for example, recognizing losses on onerous contracts, but if a contract looks like being profitable, you wait until you've done it, that is not a departure from neutrality. Turning to the business model in slightly more detail, we suggest, and there are some precedents for this in the literature, that it's helpful to categorise business into two camps. There may be some grey areas, and we don't deny that, but many businesses would seem quite naturally to be classified either as what we've called value-added businesses, that is, businesses which buy inputs and sell outputs after some kind of a transformation process. And for those, we argue that cost would be an appropriate accounting measure for their input assets. So their inventory, to give the obvious example, would normally be stated at cost, as under current practice. But when you exchange it for a debtor, that is not an input asset. That's one that you're holding to realize. And so it's natural that you would reflect the realization amounts in its measurement. And that's what gives you your profit. And that's one of the key issues that accounting for such types of businesses needs to address, and we all know we have standards that look at tricky areas like long-term contracts and so on. The other main type of business model we identify is the price change model, where the whole point is that you acquire a portfolio of assets and sometimes liabilities in the hope that you will profit from price changes. And when you're in such a camp, then some form of current value, perhaps fair value, would seem to be a totally natural response. And I should clarify that although we presented it that way, we're not saying that for each reporting entity one would have to put them in one camp or the other. Indeed, we say that if a value-added business has some assets that are more of a price change activity, they should be combined and would be at current value rather than held at cost. Moving on to the performance reporting aspects, we think that our emphasis on the business model, which we think is discussed by Tom in his paper, I'm not sure that he would agree with that particular characterization of it, but he makes the point that if you're buying shares in a grocer, you want to know how good they are at selling groceries. And so we think that some kind of operating profit, as we touched on earlier today, should be probably required. We recognize problems of definition, but we think they're probably not insurmountable, that an accounting standard could give adequate guidance. Moving on to the P&L, OCI and recycling, we suggest that one of the things that needs to be considered is providing some kind of objective or statement or something that characterizes what the profit or loss account is for. We've set out the FRC's suggestion. I don't think we're intend to say that's the absolute last word. That's not the quest of what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to illustrate what kind of statement might be contained perhaps in the conceptual framework. But we do think that our suggestion focuses on the results of the period. And that has got important implications for recycling. It also, our suggested objective has the other implication that unlike Tom's paper, we wouldn't stop our first statement after operating profit. We think that other things need to be there as well. All impairments, discontinued operations are important for an assessment of stewardship. So we suggest they would be there. And for clarity, we would of course include non-recurring items. Does that mean the profit or loss includes all gains and losses? Well, we think not. We think there are some that might be argued to actually impair the profit and loss account from fulfilling the kind of objective we see. We discuss them in the paper, and the examples we discuss are listed on slide 11. Consequences for recycling. Unlike the ASBJ, we don't think, and because we focus very much on the profit and loss account as being a result of the period, we don't believe that everything needs to be recycled. That seems to come from those who believe that, in some sense, all gains and losses must ultimately end up in the profit and loss account. And so they're trying to make the profit and loss account do some sort of cumulative duty, in the sense that it catches up at some stage or another with everything. We think that recycling should be required only when it faithfully represents an event of the period. And we discuss a couple of examples of that in the paper. The last two slides are a summary of a summary. but if you want the real net on it, this is our best stab. We think that information that assists an assessment of the business model is relevant. We think it would be useful if the conceptual framework confirmed that. That's not to say that information that does not assist an assessment of the business model is irrelevant. So we're not saying that information should not be reported. But we think we should ensure that all the information is there and presented in a way that enables an assessment of the business model. We repeat the ideas of prudence, both as asymmetry or timely loss recognition and as caution, as a reaction to uncertainty. As regards measurement, we think that the, or we suggest that the operational assets of our value-added business should be reported at cost. The key reason for that is so that you can see the margin that's achieved on sale. You can see the difference between the sale proceeds and the costs of the assets that have been sacrificed or consumed in making that sale. As I've said, the purpose of the profit or loss should be described with disclosure of an operating profit, and that description that you give of the profit and loss account should be what inspires our views of the use of other comprehensive income and recycling. So that's the boring bit over with. We now have your comments.
Yukio?
We support the publication of the FRC paper and very much appreciate that the FRC carefully considered the SBJ paper and referred to the paper in a number of discussions. As it would be evident in the paper, we share common views in the number of areas. Having said that, we have the two comments on the paper. Firstly, the recycling. Unlike the view stated in the FRC paper, we believe that recycling is necessary as a system to ensure the consistency between profit or loss throughout the period and the cash flows throughout the period. This does not necessarily mean that recycling is automatic, described in the FRC slide page 12. And also, we agree that recycling should be faithfully represent an event of the period. Secondly, concept of business model. We are not sure what is meant by the business model in this paper, especially we are not sure what level of obligation the FRC considers to be appropriate when it refers to the concept of business model. For example, we are not sure if the paper intends that the business model is at the level of consistent with segment reporting or at much lower level such as a project unit. Also, we are not sure whether the FRC intends to embed the notions of observability or verifiability in the concept of business model. We strongly agree that the notion of business model or its similar notion is highly relevant to determine measurement basis of an asset or liability from perspective of reporting an entity's financial performance. However, we think that the notions of observability and verifiability are not determining factors in considering what measurement basis would be relevant as a concept level.
I would like to start with a comment that is very remotely linked to the paper itself by saying that at the time the ISB will want to assess the effectiveness of ASAF. I think this series of discussions around this topic should be taken as an example of the type of very stimulating discussions that ASAF allows, going from a paper to the next. And enriching the thinking of everyone. Yeah. So I wanted to start with that because I think it's characteristic of what is happening in this group.
Yeah.
Coming to the paper now, you're not going to be surprised that two things. First of all, the paper has not by magic eliminated the type of diversity of thinking that may still be the case in Europe around this issue. But so I had to mention that, but I think that it attracts also a lot of support. EFRAG and FRC have worked closely on the business model, worked closely on prudence, and the way, in fact, the paper builds on the ASBG paper and also with Tom's paper and brings the business model and prudence in is particularly welcome and supportive. I would like to say a word around this asymmetry in recognition that is associated to the definition of prudence in the paper, and clearly highlight that to us this is reflected in the current IFRS. So when you think of bringing back prudence in the conceptual framework, we expect that in fact the way prudence has been applied in current IFRS would be fully reflected, so that would be part of it. And I find it important to mention that, because we are currently, you know, that we will have to, in our endorsement process, to assess whether IFRS are prudent, and it's likely that those definitions will help doing that. I would like to maybe bring a few issues, highlight a few other more detailed issues. The paper could not introduce or reflect on the different business models in a less binary way than it is done. As a result, I mean, it takes away the time horizon that necessarily plays a role. And so it's, in a first step, a simplified approach. And when it comes to describing the results of the period and emphasizing that it is the result of the period, I'm sure that we could find many different people that would define the result of the period differently. And for some of them, a change in price is an event of the period, whereas for some others, you still need some form of transaction to take place before it becomes, and the change becomes an event of the period. So I don't, even if we would agree to that definition, I think it could mask a certain number of different views nevertheless. And probably in reading this paper, I thought that an element that could play a role in distinguishing whether this transaction adds something to the fact that in the past you have had a price change could be linked to two factors. First of all, whether the market is liquid or not. And if the market is liquid, this you don't have any kind of selling effort to make, and probably the transaction is less relevant than if the market is not liquid. And the other point is whether, in fact, in relation to your business model, this selling transaction would be something you would want to report from, for example, a stewardship perspective, when you report on how you have indeed made your decisions, because your selling decision then has a particular relevance to how you've handled. So these are, in my view, kind of details, but maybe also details around which different views arise in the discussion. So I thought they were quite too much.
Clement?
Yeah. I think our constituents think that it's a very good paper in provoking thoughts, following the ASBJ paper and the FASB paper on OCI. And on the operating income, not surprisingly, because of Koreans' practice in disclosing that operating profit, the paper touch upon, you know, the one of the possible operating income definition would be to exclude the one-time non-recurring items, and you know, our member actually thinks that provide a better reflection on the operating performance. So agreeing on the suggestion on the paper in that respect. And as far as recycling is concerned, again, you know, we are having quite a diverse field within our region. Some members are really, you know, sort of for the recycling, some are really not. So, but this paper at least provides some sort of conceptual thinking about, you know, when the recycling should kick in. And as far as the the definition of value-added business and price-changing business, some of the members are having concern that some of the business may not be easily defined in either one. So that is something that that need further thinking. And I'm sure my Australian friend could add on to that. And yeah, just about.
Liesl? Oh, sorry, Tom. No?
I'm not from Australia, nor is Tom.
And they wouldn't admit either of us.
Temporary. I didn't know in which sort of sequence we take it. I wanted to come first of all back to the asymmetry. One item you might have seen was a debate at IFRIC about the asymmetry in IS 37 and the asymmetry in IS 12. So currently there are variations or versions of asymmetry in the IFRS literature, and it depends very much in which standard you fall, how asymmetrical you are, meaning the virtually certain or the sort of more likely than not. And I think people might fall into whatever they rather like to fall into, and of course some Germans would rather fall into the virtually certain rather than the more likely or not, which in a way means we haven't got an absolutely clear view of what we mean by asymmetrical. And I think if we go that route, we need to be clearer about that. And to what extent it's prudent or not, I guess I could make a wild connection to hedge accounting. That's, by the way, where one EFRAGTECH member, I seem to remember, made the point that there are indeed other business models, like the net interest rate margin business model, so to speak, and that asymmetry would greatly distort what he was trying to do by having things on both sides at the same time in whatever financial statement. So going into details, we're going to stumble here and there, and I think we've got a way to go yet.
Gavin?
A blast there. Thanks, Clement. You must have got me up the queue. A bit of broken record commentary. I think when I look at Akuo's paper and I look at Tom's paper and I look at what Andrew's done, I can see different concepts of capital running through those. I suspect there may even be a different concept of capital in the front of this paper and in the appendix. And you know, we can stand off and compare what we like and dislike, but I still don't understand why we don't address that topic more directly and at least get on the table that we're coming from different perspectives. Andrew quite rightly anticipates that some people might argue with his rendition of what is prudence, and I certainly would, because an impairment under one model is a loss of an asset, and it's hardly prudence, it's just trying to be factual. And under that same model, you don't write up unless you've got you don't take a gain unless you've actually got a gain of operating capacity. So there's a reason under one model why you would come to those answers, and it's not driven off prudence, it's driven off what you're trying to measure or not measure. So I didn't find too many of the prudence examples that helpful. The inconsistencies that exist through the standards because of different recognition and criteria is a weakness in the standards, and it ought to be addressed. I don't see any reason why the hurdle should be at different heights when it's the horse that is the thing you should focus on. Can it get over the hurdle rather than should we change the height of the hurdle? The business models question is interesting because it sort of brings home to me what your unit of account is when you think that way. You've talked about two different types of business, and broadly, I accept, you know, you can have value-added businesses and price-added price or price change businesses, but it's not particularly helpful when you have a lot of exceptions to that sort of classification. You know, an insurance business, what is that? It's very interested in price change, but it's also very interested in service. So it's adding value and watching price changes. And one of the things I exhorted of the CF team was, when you think about measurement, start with the premise that prices are changing very significantly. Because I think we often fall back on historical cost because implicitly we're saying there isn't much of a price change there. But I would say to you, where price changes are significant, no matter whether you're a value-added business or a price change business, you will be interested in price changes, and you'll be interested in both input changes, prices in changes in input prices, and changes in exit prices. So just having a binary classification between broad types of business didn't help me much. It left me wondering whether you were going to say everybody who was in price change land as an entity, even if parts of their entity weren't price change, you go to current value, and if you're in value added, you all go to historical cost. I didn't think that's what you meant, but what was I supposed to really deduct from the classification? I would take your analysis down to an asset level and invite you to think it again at that level of account and see where that brings you out. You're going to face some dilemmas because you take a property developer, who runs a hotel in the property that they have. They might buy an existing hotel, run a business in it and sell it. They may construct the property, put a business in it and sell it. Or they may construct the asset with an intention of putting a business in it and sell it anyway. So there's a whole series of permutations where entities will swap from one focus to another. In a past life, one of my clients indirectly was Li Kai-shing. He's a guy who runs enormous businesses, but he also is a fabulous trader. He does both at once. He's made a lot of money out of buying and selling businesses, but a lot of money within businesses. So I don't know how to classify him. The other question that came to mind with business models is, why do we want to know about business models? I think it's interesting information and it's indicative of some things we should think about, but I don't think it's going to drive me one way or the other on measurement. But I do observe that in accounting standards, we've used it as a constraint. So if there is a choice where we could measure one attribute of a standard or another attribute of a standard, we said, okay, you make your choice, but you don't get to change that choice if your business model doesn't change. To me, that's a different level of use of the model than what you're talking about, which is more fundamental, I think, to measure. I'm sorry, Yuko, you're never going to get me over the line on recycling. I won't dwell on that, but for me, recycling just defeats the definition of revenue and expense when you recycle. And I believe it should be consistent with your elements.
Tom?
I was particularly gratified to see this paper written, in part because my effort last time was not to be definitive, but to raise some issues for our consideration. And I think you've raised and raise different aspects of similar issues in a way that gets to different conclusions. But what I'd like to comment on mostly is where I see and why there are differences in the outcomes in the two papers. My constraint when I wrote the paper, because my conclusions are probably not the way I voted as a board member in that paper, but I constrained myself to saying two things. There will be a mixed attribute model, within companies. And I want to think about accounting most consistent with how we define the objective of financial reporting. And I think within those discussions, last in my paper, I raised issues about business model in some respects by talking about operating and non-operating. And I raised issues about prudence. But my view is that my core arguments didn't make either of those the most fundamental issues that drove the outcome. And I want to explore the reasons why. Okay. I, like your paper, would generally in measurement be thinking about value-added activities at amortized cost and price change activities at fair value. But it would not be based simply on that. And here's the reason why. I believe the value-added activity decision in this paper and the price change decision in this paper are at the start of the activity. And what I did in my paper was to say, and look more generally speaking, to say, if I want to know about the amount, timing, and uncertainty of future cash inflows and management's ability or what will happen to management's decisions when things change economically over time, whether they might change the economic model, I change the view from not where you start, but where, what do you have the ability to change your business model? And that's where the two papers differ, I think, most significantly. That's why I raised the criterion as whether there's not, unlike what Francois just said, impediments to sale internally because they're value-added activities with the assets used synergistically, or impediments to sale externally because there's no market. In those settings, you can't get out of, you can't change your business model. So mine's was a change in business model perspective, where this paper was more upfront. But if you could change the business model, I thought the accounting to understand amount, timing, and uncertainty of cash flows and management stewardship over the assets ought to reflect the impact of a changing model. That is, if I started off cash collecting, if I could sell it, I would sell it, and therefore, that's naturally going to occur. You're going to sell it if it's advantageous. Pick up that unrealized gain or loss always. So that was a relevance issue, but just to raise, if we're going to be arguing about measurement and presentation going forward, there's one perspective of business models at day one and maybe changing business models that have been put on the table. And that's not to suggest that's an all-encompassing set of issues, but there's a difference there. Second of all, so business models not primary is the way these gentlemen talked about it in their paper to me. It's the ability to change the business model based on impediments. In terms of presentation, I too say, like they do, operating is really important. And I want to know both recurring and non-recurring amounts of operating so that people going forward, if there's non-recurring parts of operating, they can weigh it less so or do something differently with it, like Clement was talking about. But then I raised the question that if I've got operating in a highlighted operating number, and therefore everything else that's in the second statement I'm talking about, I thought would be weighed less significantly by market participants. And if it's weighed less significantly, you know what's recurring and non-recurring, what does profit and loss do for me? And while both the ASBJ and the FRC papers maintain that we ought to have profit or loss, I'm not sure that we can come up with a definition for it. While there's a proposal in paragraph 5.8 of this paper, I think I'd be challenged, and the authors of the paper very effectively indicated some items that are on one side of that line. I don't know that I could apply that definition easily to all of the items in the second and sort them well, and that we like the outcome. And so I'm not ever sure that we're going to end up being able to define profit and loss in the middle of that second statement as being a consistent, meaningful number. That was all I was raising. In saying, really, almost that whole second statement is what are items that are less important. That's what we've been calling OCI. You figure out how you want to think about them, and less importantly, as recurring or non-recurring, and let it go. And so I'd leave the question open. I think both in the ASBJ BJ paper and the FRC paper, an assertion is we've got to have profit or loss. And the only thing I'll add to the conversation again is why? What do we get out of it? And I'm not sure we do. And I don't think we can consistently.
Because people want it. And people use it.
But so I agree with that, Hans. But I think what they've done with all the non-GAAP measures is say, yeah, you sort of got there, but you didn't get there far enough.
Yeah.
So after we get there far enough with operating income, do they really need it, is a question I'm asking.
And OCI is our own non-GAAP measure.
And maybe we're never going to figure that out consistently is all I'm raising. And so I challenge, put that back, challenge into the system. In terms of the appendix of the paper, yes, there's many other things we could do with a comprehensive single attribute model, and that's what you'd have to do with the with what's happening in the appendix of the paper, because you can't do holding gains on some inputs and not others and have it have any meaning. We can't ever get to your capital maintenance concept if we have multiple mixed attribute models within an entity. But if we do, we'd have to do it comprehensively, and then I think you'd have to do it both on input price changes and output price changes, because the biggest thing I'd like to know is if input price changes, what's my ability to pass them through to my customers? And how much? I don't have any. I have a little. And having just an entry price change in that is probably not sufficient. But I don't believe any of us are willing or ready yet to go to a full-blown model where we can get the capital maintenance other, politically at least, other than what Kevin's been arguing over time. So those are my observations. But I think we are starting to talk about this in the depth that we need to, if we're going to move forward to really doing conceptual framework on presentation and measure.
I also thought it was a very rich paper. I have been thinking and struggling a lot with the chapter on prudence, which the board has been struggling with last week, especially this this notion of asymmetry in recognition. And is that really the essence of cost accounting for operating assets? I don't think that is the case. Yes, it is true we are not interested in gains on operating assets and we don't record them unless they are realized. But in principle we are also not interested in the decline in value aside from depreciation of operating assets unless costs are no longer recoverable and cost accounting becomes problematical. And I think that this bringing forward of impairment is basically a recognition of the primitiveness of cost accounting and the drawbacks of cost accounting no longer applies because the cost can no longer be recovered. But we are equally uninterested in upward gains and declines in market value of operating assets unless cost is no longer recoverable. So I don't think it is asymmetric. Certainly not what it was meant to be. I also think that I do agree that there are some standards, especially the recognition of intangibles, where there is some asymmetry, but that is at the fringes of our standards and where there is huge measurement uncertainty. But I think if we would define prudence as asymmetry in recognition, I think we would confuse a lot of people and it would be widely seen as a choice for conservatism and a bias for conservatism. And I think we would lose a lot of users then. I don't think users want that. I don't think that's what is meant here, but I think that, or it's certainly not what has been meant in this paper, but I think if you define prudence was one element of prudence as a systematic asymmetry in recognition, I think that would lead us into a lot of problems. So I think it's factually not completely true. It's true for other standards, not, but I don't think for cost accounting, for operating assets, and it would all have all sorts of by effects, I'm afraid. François?
I reacted to what you just said, Hans, because you have added a term that I didn't read in the paper. You said it's a systematic asymmetry, and I don't think the paper refers to systematic asymmetry. So it's not that you would in all cases do that, but you would wonder whether in the conditions of uncertainty you are in, whether this kind of asymmetry should be applied.
Yeah, but this so this relates to cost accounting, which is far removed from the subject. Well, can cost account can also be very subjective, of course. But well, I'm going to repeat what I said.
I want to ask a few questions around the page, slide 7, business model. First one, Francois. I think it is definite, you know, we have to take into consideration business model because of the objective and the relevance and the faithful representation, quality requirement. But I think the dilemma for us is, you know, to what extent we should take into consideration. And AFRAC also raised a proposal to ask the board to discuss complexity. I think the dilemma is, if you purely look at slide 7, it's quite straightforward, easy. But people want more. You know, think about debates on FI classification measurements and insurance, leasing. You know, if you purely say it is a very added, looks like have only one basis, one broad measurement basis. It's quite easy. And if you purely look at some instruments or some business, it's purely price changes, it's easier, you fair value. But as we observed, you know, the past the debate over FI, insurance, and leasing, and it looks like it's consumers saying one more. And then if the board said, okay, then accounting standards will become more complicated. So how to balance between them, Francois? My second question is to Andrew. You know, I don't see very clearly something in between accumulated in the history, like PPE revaluation. You touch a little bit in the paper. And the biological asset, fair value option, and finally, investment property at fair value or cost. So, which side or something in between? If you say something in between, then in the future people more want more, you know, just like FI OCR category, you know, something we'll say that we hold, but also for sale purpose.
Yeah.
And my last question is to Tom or Clement, you know, about operating profit. I personally feel without, you know, considering OCI or profit loss, the indicator or that number, as Tom said, it seems very simple and straightforward. You know, record operating profit, as Clement said, recurring. Then it will not be so easy, you know, for, you know, manufacturing industry, it's basically, it's quite straightforward. But how about most of the financial, you know, service industry? How to distinguish between, you know, operating profit from recurring business and profit loss from price changes? And Kevin mentioned about insurance business, have service part, also have value chain part. So my question to Tom on Clement, you know, the third one.
Should I start with the first question? On the relationship between business model and complexity, I think when we discuss complexity, we agreed that there was a certain level of unavoidable complexity. So that if you have a lot of diversity in the way, in the economic positions of entities, I mean, accounting should indeed go to the extent of reflecting that diversity. And if you were ignoring the business model, you would get into some form of uniformity that would probably be simple, but that would be at the expense of relevance in financial reporting. That's what we think. And I think almost everyone that spoke in the comments around the two business models acknowledged the fact that life is bringing more diversity than just two categories. But if the business model was simple enough to be one or the other, I would note that there would not be the need for any form of OCI, because you would not have different measurement bases in the financial position and in the financial performance. So obviously, if you have OCI, it's because you have in some business models a bit of one and the other, and you want to capture that. So to conclude on this part of the question, yes, the business model is a necessary tool to reflect reality in an avoidable level of complexity.
Kevin?
I just wanted to go back on the exhortation I made, Andrew and Roger, about taking your thinking down to an asset level. As I've mentioned in other arenas, I was always struck by Neil Forster's idea of thinking about an asset and all of its attributes. And many of the areas of accounting we get excited about, we're thinking of one or more attributes of the item, and we were doing that just before with portfolio revaluation approach. We were thinking of attributes there. And so I think if you're up at the business level, you've aggregated up a lot of different characteristics, and what you're hearing people say is they can't quite put everybody into one or two boxes. You bring it down to the individual asset level and recognize that there are different attributes that every asset might have. Sometimes they're irrelevant to the entity, because if they were to trade the asset, they'd be out of business. Other times they've got to trade the asset to be in business. We're down to that level. There is a payoff, I believe, in the long run in derecognition, if we can get our thinking around the attributes of an asset, because a lot of our derecognition is, have we still got it or have we lost it, when in fact we've got rid of part of the attribute and kept part of the attribute. So I think the business model has a part to play in bringing out for us that assets have different attributes that are used differently in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So, can I respond to Wego and build off of what Kevin just said? Well, my model, when I talked about it, it has ties to the business model. It isn't a measurement choice based on the collective activities of the entity or the collective activities of assets or liabilities. It's a decision based on what you can do with an individual asset or liability. So I would say that's probably not a business model, though it captures many of the outcomes similar to their paper. So in a banking institution, if you have no impediments to sale because there's markets available for your financial assets, and those assets are not used in a synergistic basis or needing to be transformed in any way to create value, all of them would be a fair value. And you'd have to ask the same things for liabilities. Okay? But many of the banking liabilities, well, deposits you probably can transfer. There's a market for them. But other borrowings you probably cannot. But it's much more likely, inherent in your question, I think, Wego, was a belief that for operating activities, generally speaking, the measurement would be amortized costs, and that's not the outcome of my model. So for financial institutions, it could very well be fair value on the assets and fair value of the demand deposits, because there's no impediment to sell them, either of them, okay, and they're not used necessarily synergistically to create value. And so you'd have that mapping at the same measurement attribute within the system. The only challenge in a financial institution is what's operating, what's non-operating, and I'd say almost everything's operating. Because even if you talk about liabilities, they're operating finance, they're the funding of the assets. So you have very little things outside the operating category, from my view. But that's a difference that might make the model a little bit more easier to apply to individual assets and liabilities,
and more flexible, but still be very sensitive to all the business model aspects that Roger and Andrew were talking about in that paper. So that's why I am saying my model isn't a fundamental business. The key aspect isn't business model, but it captures many of the implications of what people talk about related to business model.
I was wondering when I read the paper, with knowing Andrew's history and preferences, whether he wasn't reflecting a bit deprival of that, which again is getting back to individual assets and how the business can best use them. And it's just about what you're describing, Tom.
Yeah.
No? It's a methodology for getting to that answer.
Yeah, I certainly didn't see the line the way that I was describing value-added businesses as having assets which are inputs to his operations as being fundamentally different from your criteria about it not making economic sense to sell them. I mean, maybe we should have brought some more of that language in.
The only place I had pause is when you said loans from banks are necessarily value-added activities.
I agree, and I think I did say arguably. I didn't want to get into a debate on financial institutions, but I think some would say that that would apply for the keeping the banking book at cost or amortized cost.
I think the problem was that was, I suppose, an oversimplified paper to try and keep it down to a reasonable length, and I think if we'd have gone into all of these issues, it would have been 100 pages long, yeah. And no one would have read it. So, can I just come back on one point? I think this asymmetry notion, we've come at it as an aspect of prudence, really, because that's how, I suppose, how our constituents view it. But I don't think it necessarily need to be an aspect of prudence. I think it's just there, though. And I think at the moment it's not really reflected in the conceptual framework. They might say, actually, it comes off the cost model. But there's more to it than that. I mean, even in insurance at the moment, we're saying we're not going to take day one gains. But we're going to take day one losses. And there's large aspects of that. Liesl says, quite correctly, that when you're looking at the taking a hit, an impairment, that at the moment in various standards there are different shades of what probability you need to do that, or even what probability you need to avoid it. So I do feel it needs to be thought about, and the conceptual framework needs to explain why we do have this asymmetry all over the place. Now, I think accounting standard or the conceptual framework is not meant to be a series of rules. It's meant to be a series of concepts, and sometimes you favor one concept over another. So in a normal value-added business, you tend to take the gain when you make the sale. But in a contracting business, you don't. And why is that? Because it's more relevant to report the gains you're making over a long-term contract in those years, rather than waiting right to the end of the contract, which used to be the accounting many years ago. So there, although it's a value-added business, asymmetry loses out to relevance. But asymmetry is frequently a feature, which is to say, it just doesn't get mentioned in the conceptual framework, and probably it needs to be.
And maybe not with the label of prudence.
No.
And probably that's unhelpful. Yeah.
I guess in the discussions that we had, and appreciated the paper actually trying to pull together several different concepts, because we do think the framework, the concepts are interrelated, so the discussion needs to be considered in that way. I guess part of the challenge that we would have is what you look at, for example, asymmetry in this example cited, those tend to be more outcomes of our current accounting approaches. Mm. And I guess the group that we connect with quite a bit in our conceptual framework discussion group has more foresight to say, when the board is setting standards, what are the factors that should be considered? And a lot of the time we look to the qualitative characteristics as providing that guidance. Yep. So when you think of day one gains, for example, as you were just citing, it's the uncertainty, because we're developing an existence in a very subjective estimate. But if I could find a current market value that would verify that, then maybe I would recognize it. So as Kevin suggested, if you could drill down a little further to talk about the different characteristics of the item or the scenario, it kind of slips into the business model notion as well. That's what we're trying to depict in order to provide the relevant information that faithfully represents those circumstances. So I guess we'd find it helpful if we could talk about it at that level, so then we have specific factors that we consider going forward.
Possibly, although what we were trying to do, I suppose, is to put what is actually in accounting, and it's largely what users want. So we actually took this paper to several groups of users in the UK, with about the two large groups, and they both said, yes, that actually explains what we want. We're not quite sure, we don't understand the conceptual frameworks, we don't know how you get there, but that's what we want. So I think we have to be quite careful going off that sort of accounting before we're quite sure that is what users want. So if users say, yes, we want day one games, that's fine. But we have to make sure they do want day one games before we go there.
Yeah, except, I mean, on the other hand, Roger, we've heard that users are quite keen on neutrality so they can make their own prudent adjustments. It's going back to prudence. And that they worry that if it's up to management as to how much bias or prudence they build in.
I think you're talking about measurement there, though. It's very easy to confuse measurement and recognition. I mean, if the standard is clear when you recognise, there's not much management discretion. You recognise the gain on selling inventory when you sell it. But I agree, on measurement, there should be absolutely no bias. It should be absolutely neutral in some sort of dictionary sense. But on recognition, the current standards don't take you to the day one gain as an example. Now, there's no management discretion. You just don't take day one gains by and large in accounting.
Yeah, there's judgment as there is on anything in some cases.
What's that?
I think the issue indeed turns around the definition also of neutrality. If you have neutrality defined as in this paper, there is no impediment to prudence. If you start deciding that neutrality means that standard setters should deal with assets exactly in the same way as liabilities, then you get an issue. And we found in this academic literature review that we sponsored together with ICAS elements justifying that users want to know immediately of losses and can wait for certain gains. So this asymmetry in the way users respond to inferential reporting has academic literature evidence to it.
Glenn?
I'd just like to respond to Weigock's question earlier about, you know, the operating profit. I'm not 100% convinced that the business model should be one of the overriding factors that people should look at for measurement, but it definitely, you know, sort of provides some sort of light on the presentation area. And as far as the operating profit is concerned, I think it does give, you know, people some sort of basis about, you know, what should be, because of the model, the business model, what should be included in the operating profit. And the measurement, because of the value-added business or price-driven business, the measurement might be different. But if we're looking at a situation whereby you could have two different sort of measurement basis. Initial thought maybe the operating profit could further, you know, sort of subdivide it into different, you know, sort of valuation basis as well.
Any other comments? No? Okay.
Well, thanks to everyone for their comments.
Yeah, and thank you for producing a really good paper.
The maps for dinner tonight are on. You should all have the maps. They should have been on the table.
Is it 7 o'clock?
No, six 6:30. It says here. Yeah.
Cocktails. You want to have a drink? I wouldn't recommend it.